Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, David, for this invitation. And I will try to bring you into my world of what I call the neuronal or neurogenic control of the cerebral circulation. And this is an adventure that actually started when I was a postdoc in California. And I came back to it several years after. So I don't know why there are colors lying in my presentation that were not there. So I don't know. It's the first time it's happening. So a new era here. So this is a cast of the human brain. And I think it's important to know what we're talking about when we're talking about the cerebral circulation. This is the surface vessels where we have the pill vessel, the cerebral arteries, the veins. And as you can see here, there are some penetrating blood vessels, some arteries that will go inside the cerebral cortex, and then they will ramify into capillaries. And this is another one here. You have big veins as well. So this will be referred to as the extracerebral circulation, and this is the intraparenchymal circulation. And when we're talking about neurovascular coupling, this is where it's happening, okay? The innervation of the large cerebral vessel is really not too much concern at that time. So this is a view, just to summarize that. So all of the extracerebral blood vessels are innervated by the peripheral nervous system. So from nerves coming from cerebral ganglia and the project nerves, very nicely delineated around the vessels. And this has been done, you know, in the 70s, in the 80s, very much so. Lars Edvinson in Sweden was one of the very important guy in terms of delineating the innervation of these outside vessel. When we go inside the cerebral circulation, and this is what I would like to talk to you about. First, I would like to go anatomically, because I think we have to take into consideration that there are nerve fibers or afferent that will go from subcortical nuclei projecting into the cortical mantle, and these afferent input will go to pyramidal cells, they will go to interneuron, they will go to astrocyte, they will also go to blood vessel. So there are the subcortical afferent. But when you are locally where the integration is really happening, then you will have to consider the signal coming from the afferents that are being integrated by the interneurons and the pyramidal cells. When I first published this in 2006, I didn't put the pyramidal cells into that. It's not that I don't think they do nothing. Is that the review was on the interneuron, but I think we have to move on, and I've added a nice pyramidal cell to that slide, and I will be talking today about some of the pyramidal neurons effect, okay? Well, that's the dendrite. You can have a small projection here that will go on. We don't know exactly in terms of blood vessels, you know, where they go, so it's just one projection.
I have a serious question about this. If you look at the surface vasculature,
yeah. Yeah, well, I think this is clearly how the blood supply to the brain is regulated. The autoregulation is happening at this level. So all of that is the main, it's like the highway bringing blood to the brain. What is being taught is that when you have a local regulation by increased neural activity locally, there is a retrograde dilatation that seems to convey signal that they need blood locally, so then the blood vessel will be dilating to provide blood locally. So there is this, what they call this upstream vasodilatation that seems to probably be regulated by astrocytic gap junction, transmitting signal along the penetrating arteries or the vessel that are issued from the pill vessel. I think this is as far as we know about it at that point. Some, I think it's not excluded that there will be signaling also along the blood vessel wall, whether they would be the smooth muscle cells or the endothelial cells. I think there is no closed idea there. There is the work by Dale Pellegrino in Chicago, who has looked at some of the gap junction in the astrocyte that could be conveying this signal. I don't know if you have looked into that actually, Brian, or if you are looking into that, but as far as I know, what we call is retrograde dilatation. So I don't think it would be something coming out, because the nerve fibers do not go really out on the outside vessel. So if there is an integration coming, you know, locally, the fibers do not really project to this outside vessel. So it will have to be conveyed upstream, and probably it's a vascular effect, whether it's astrocytic or directly into the blood vessel. I think there is no firm decision about that at that point. This is an interneuron, just to show an interneuron, and this will
be subcortical.
It can be a neuron coming from the locus coeruleus, the raphe nucleus, the basal forebrain, the thalamus, that is just projecting to the cortex. It is just to show you an afferent input from a subcortical nucleus.
And what is the subcortical area?
Well, you will also have vessels penetrating the thalamus, penetrating the hippocampus, so you will also have local integration there. We have not done any work personally there. Martin Lauritsen has worked in the hippocampus. I don't think there are many groups looking into the local regulation in the basal forebrain or in the thalamus, even though those are irrigated, obviously, as well. But most of the work has been done in superficial cortex.
And the big supply lines for the subcortical areas? Like the big...
You have large, like the striatum, for example, you will have the lenticulate arteries that will be perforating from the middle sibyl artery, and then they will go deep into the tissue. Those will be very large arteries, actually. And then they would ramify within the striatum, for instance. It's the same in the hippocampus. You have penetrating vessels that are coming, very large branches from the pia, and then they will ramify locally within the hippocampus. Well, they actually come into the pia. You know, they actually come through the pia and they will go into the hippocampus. So you have main, they are not capillaries when they come in. They are still arteries when they come in into the deep structures there. But I think very little has been done in terms of the local regulation in thalamus or in very deep nuclei, actually. Yes? The hippocampal arteries, I'm just trying to figure it out, because they are main vessels, and you can see them align actually very well into the fissure of the hippocampus. What is the main driving vessel? If it's a branch from the choroidal artery, which I wouldn't be surprised, because the choroid plexus is getting into the ventricle, and it would be probably possible that it goes and gave a branch to the hippocampus. So, I mean, I could check that, but it is coming into the ventricular system, and then you have the branches. I'm not sure if it's I'm not sure if it's the same one.
I'm pretty sure it's connected to the surface pleural vessels.
They go into the ventricular system.
It's also fed there, and then branches come into the hippocampal fissure, then feed the hippocampus.
Because I think, you know, the ventricle, you have the choroid plexus, and you have vessels going inside the ventricle. I think it might be one of those that gives branches to the hippocampus. And then you see them very well aligned. They're very nice, and you see them well aligned, actually. So, but most of the work, I mean, in our lab and in most of the lab, has been done in the cortex, where you can see those penetrating going in there, okay? So what I will try today is to talk about interneurons, obviously, and try as well to talk about two afferent input to the cortex, trying to see how they can actually influence this network there. If we think that blood vessels are doing something when we have an increase in neural activity, something that we wanted to look at is, are they really receiving an input from these pathways? So I'm going to show you light microscopy and EM microscopy, so we know what we're talking about when we're talking about the vessels and neurons. So this is a dye. It's a retrograde tracer that we have injected inside the basal forebrain. So this is one of these nucleus here. So we injected the dye into the basal forebrain, and then it's a dye, it's a tracer. And then we waited 10 days to 14 days to follow the anterograde transport of this tracer into the cortex. And as you can see, the dye is actually, this tracer is going all the way into axon. Some of them will come into really surrounding the vessel inside the cortex, whether they are penetrating arteries or very small blood vessel, and they are varicose fibers. So this is probably, at the light microscopic level, the closest you can talk about innervation of blood vessel, fibers going into the vessel wall and circling around them and touching them. But what is it when we talk about that at the EM level? So if we move on at the electron microscopic level, so this is here a small vessel where we see multiple terminals here. Those are labeled for choline acetyltransferase, so they are cholinergic nerve terminals. They come from the basal forebrain, because if we do lesion the basal forebrain, we lose 80% of those terminals. And as you can see, some of them are located around, some come very close. These, no. If I could do the same for the basal forebrain looking at the phaseolus injection, it's the same. But now I'm moving to the cholinergic one, but they would look the same. Yes, they are. These one, as I said, if we lesion the basal forebrain, we lose about 80% of those. So there might be 20% of the terminals that are cholinergic around the vessel that come from the inner neuron.
But could it be all the cholinergic fibers around the vessel from the neuron?
No, because if I do a lesion here, I destroy the basal forebrain, which is the seat of the cholinergic projection to the cortex. If I lesion that, I have about 80% less cholinergic terminals around the vessel. Around the vessel and in the cortex, as you know, in the cortex as well, because I think the neurons will provide afferents to the cortex at large, and some of those afferents would go to the blood vessel. So that's why, you know, we can say, we've done that, it's published, we can say that if you do a lesion of the basal forebrain, you lose 80% of the cholinergic terminals. So about 20% could be coming from interneurons. However, interneurons are not in human or in primate, they're only in the rodents. So in the human, all the cholinergic innervation to the cortex is coming from the basal forebrain. There is no single cholinergic interneuron in the human cortex. Okay, so this is a difference between human and rodent that may be important. And we also like the basal forebrain because it's the nucleus that degenerates in Alzheimer's disease. So when you have Alzheimer's disease, you lose the afferent to the cortex. It is due to the degeneration of the basal forebrain, which is the unique system providing cholinergic innervation to the cortex in human. Okay? So these are terminals that we can see around vessels. If we then try to map the distance that they would be located around a vessel, so we draw, just arbitrarily, we drew a 3 micrometer perimeter from the basal lamina of the vessel up to 3 micron, and then we measured where were those terminals around that perimeter of the blood vessel. As you can see here, this is a dendrite, this is another dendrite, this is here a nerve terminal with varicosities. So we counted only the varicosities with vesicle that could relieve actually something. And as you can see here, there is what we call a glial leaflet, or what has been really referred to during the last days, those ANFI. So these surroundings here are the glial ANFI that we see between the basal lamina and a nerve terminals. Okay, so they are morphologically, we can see those. So if we actually do serial section, and this is just another section from a, you can see here a terminal coming in, a varicosity. Here there is a glial leaflet, but here the terminal is directly opposed to the basal lamina. So even though most of the time you will see a glial leaflet, some of the fibers will actually be touching the blood vessel wall itself. Okay?
However, you have the very same distribution of vesicles close to the astrocyte as well as close to
Absolutely,
the...
yes. And I think you can see here, maybe the reaction is very dense, but there is a lot of vesicle in that terminal.
So astrocytes and the endothelium will be...
Non-synaptic, non-junctional target. I'll come back to that. But I think it's totally true. If you see here, there is a lot of small vesicles in that terminal here, and it is actually opposed to a glial leaflet. So something that should be said, however, there is never a postsynaptic density. Okay? So whether it is on an astrocyte or directly on the blood vessel wall, there is never a postsynaptic density. So that means we probably need to have receptor clustering at that area to have a function. Yes? Okay, let's say I did not label and I did not really discriminate pericyte. What I can tell you is that you have about 10 times more capillaries and arterioles when you are into the cortex. Okay, so we target a lot of capillaries. So probably some of those will be surrounded by pericytes. Okay, so but I did not do an investigation of those at the EM, so I cannot tell you that there was a small pericyte here and there was an apposition. I cannot, but I am sure it exists. I am sure.
Do you see a difference in the innervation of the capillary or of the arterioles versus venules?
Okay, venules, we did not really count them because venules would be for us at the EM like a very big capillary because they have no smooth muscle per se. So they would be like a lining of endothelial cell but a very large diameter.
Is this, and is this a venule then? Or are these venules? They secret large.
Yeah, but this is a very high mag. You know, this is something like, you know. Yeah, this is here. You see here we have a smooth muscle cell. At that one, you can see here.
Okay.
So you have smooth muscle cell there. And that one here, it might be, but I think we do, if we look at it, I think most of those would be small arterial with one layer of smooth muscle cell. Okay? But we do have capillaries, like this one here would likely be a capillaries. I cannot see any smooth muscle there. Okay? But veins, I didn't investigate it, but I don't know. Pericytes, I would believe that they would be. They would be the same type of organization. I think you had a question. Okay. So then I think what is important here is that they are occasionally opposed to the vessel basal lamina, but they are primarily contacting the intervening astroglial leaflet or the end feet. So I think we should always talk, and we actually wrote that in 1996 in a review, we should be talking about neurogliovascular unit, because I think this is really what it is, even anatomically, I think so. Okay. And I think something important here is that whether I'm looking at acetylcholine, serotonergic, noradrenaline, GABA, NPY, VIP, and others, I mean, we've done personally in the lab all of these, they all have basically a very similar distribution. So I cannot tell that there is a system among these that would have all the concentration of the terminal within the half micron. They basically distribute very close to the vessel basal lamina within the first quarter of a micron. After that, they're randomly distributed. Okay, so yes. Then you will reach another vessel or another area with another vessel and another, basically you will be away from a microenvironment probably. Okay, because capillaries will probably be within 10 to 15 micron, you are likely to find another capillary or another arterial maybe 30 micron away. Synapse, I wouldn't call that synapse. You can call that a functional synapse if you do have receptors. I think then you can say it's a functioning entity. But in terms of anatomy, there is never a post-junctional density. But you would, as shown in those, there are clearly physical able to release something at that level. No, I'm going to show you what we've done for receptors, however, to address that, because this is anatomy and we've got to move beyond anatomy to know if it can work, and I'll show you what we've done. Yes? No, I'm going to show you that it can respond to a lot of other things. Absolutely. I'll come to that. I'll come to that. If you give me a minute, I'll come to that, okay? So if there is one system, actually, that was not looked at the EM, it's the glutamatergic system, okay? At the time, I think there was no good markers to label the glutamatergic synapses. I think now you could use the glutamate transporter and clearly actually GLUT1 and label the terminal. So I think that's something that could be done, but it was not done by anybody, as far as I know. But others have labeled subpopulation of the pyramidal cell, and we'll come back to that as well. Okay? So then I think, again, just to reemphasize that you do have direct, but most of them would come into the astrocyte. So this is anatomy. It's only telling you that anatomically we have the capacity that nerves will actually be talking to blood vessel. But are the vessel able to respond to the release of these transmitters? Okay, so we looked at that. I would just say, I will show you what we've done, I think in the most convincing manner. We looked at that by isolating the microvessels from the cortex. So we took tissue, we isolated the microvessels, and we grew endothelial cells from those, smooth muscle cells from those, and we also took astrocyte in the same cortical. So that then allowed us to go by molecular biology and do PCR, trying to see where are the receptor expressed. And if you look at the cholinergic receptors, because I'm going to come back to that, and if we look at the endothelial cells, we've done the smooth muscle cell, we've done the astrocyte, but I'm only going to show you here that there is the M5, muscarinic acetylcholine receptor, and the M2 in the endothelial cell. In the smooth muscle, there is an M1 receptor, if I'm not mistaken, and I believe there was an M3. So clearly, the cells of the microvessels do have receptors for here acetylcholine, okay? But is that a functional receptor as well? So then what we've done, we actually took these microarterioles in the cortex. This is human. We've taken that in human fresh tissue from the OR because we could access that. We also have done bovine tissue, but we went into the cortex. We took those about 40 micron to 50 micron large arterioles, and we mounted them in an isolated bed preparation.
How do you get
I am in a hospital where there is brain surgery, and I'm allowed to take the residual tissue. Okay, I'm not anymore, but I could.
Yeah, you're taking it during
glioma? Most of it was from epilepsy removal, so we had surroundings of quite healthy tissue, actually. No, it was clearly cortex. Yeah, always cortex. Okay, I can tell you. The endothelial cells are about, normally, I think we go above 95% easily by markers of endothelial cell. We've used antibodies to actually visualize them, and they've been counted as well. The less clean preparation is the smooth muscle cell. Oh, we first centrifuge them by gradient, so you put them on a gradient, a dextran gradient, and then we actually subclone the cells. So when you get the pellet of the capillaries and then the smooth muscle cell, we subclone one cell into the dish and let it grow, or a couple of cells. So they're very pure, okay? And as I said, these are very pure. The astrocyte gets also quite pure because you can actually treat them and remove the neurons and remove other things. The less clean prep is the smooth muscle cell, which is about 85% clean by all the markers we could test. But still, this is the best we can do, okay? So if I just then go on, and this, what we've done, we actually can show here in the human that there is a dilatation to acetylcholine, okay? And if you actually block nitric oxide synthase, we know this response is NO-dependent, and we can actually block it quite significantly. We also, and I'm saving you, but you can go to this paper in 2000 in JCBFM, we did the pharmacology, and the pharmacology matched very well the M5 muscarinic receptor with selective antagonist. Interestingly, 1 year later, in 2001, the group from Frank Paracci, with a Japanese group, had the knockout M5 muscarinic acetylcholine receptor mouse, and they showed no dilatation to acetylcholine in brain vessel. Okay, so I think that was a proof to our basically pharmacological and molecular approach that if you have a knockout mice, they have no dilatation to acetylcholine. Okay, I'm showing acetylcholine. It's the same for 5-HT. They have receptors for 5-HT. They have receptors for peptide, and I'm going to come to those here. And here I'm going to clearly recognize the work of Shinkan Tong in my lab. Yes, sorry. This is a dose response curve. We go from 10 to the minus 10 molar to about 10 to the minus 4 molar. And at 10 to the minus 7 molar, you already have half the maximal response. It's totally within the range of what could be called a physiological response. Yeah, at the site of a release of a varicosities, if you have receptors there, it can clearly reach even higher than that. Yeah, okay. So now I think this is can totally be physiological. This is a bat preparation where I do apply it. So it's clearly in vitro. It clearly is different from stimulating a nerve and looking at the response.
Right.
Absolutely.
How do you do a punctate input? Well, I...
Well, in the bath, let's say it would not really be possible because you have to put it in solution. If you would like to do that, I guess if you go in vivo and locate a vessel, and then you could probably come in and with the, you know, you have those facilities of probably just releasing acetylcholine right there at the vessel. I think that could be done as well. Yes. Nobody knows. If I were to label these arterioles here with muscarinic M5 receptors or, you know, and see where they would be, nobody has done that, okay? And a lot of times, even if you look at receptors at the EM, they are probably, they are in lower level expression than in the parenchyma. So you will pick up the one in the neurons, but it will be difficult to pick up the one in the vessel. So very few people have actually looked at that. Yes?
How vessels?
I mean, let's see, this is capillaries, arterioles, some would be vein coming back, giving branches.
What would the number be there, the pass there?
Oh, that is probably a small branch coming out of that one, and then another one.
That corkscrew. It's like a corkscrew.
Underneath two?
Yeah,
let's see, maybe they have something there, which I don't know. This is not me who has done that, okay? I'm just showing you what type of vessel we've taken to do that. So I don't know here if they had something special at that point, okay? Yeah. Yes, I don't know. Excuse me? Esterase? Cholinesterase? Acetylcholinesterase? Okay, acetylcholinesterase, will it be in the vessels, actually? You know, I've stained a lot of tissue with acetylcholinesterase. I don't recall it would be in the vessel, but acetylcholine is degraded clearly, you know, before quite rapidly locally. They have butyryl esterase in the vessel, but I'm not sure for the acetylcholinesterase. I have to leave it open there. I wouldn't want to say yes or no. I am not sure for that. Okay, so, and that, as I said here, I don't think nobody knows the distribution of the receptors, actually. So, but if we do now, this is an NPY here, so again, we always look at the pil vessel, the cortex, the microvessels, isolated before we grow the cells from them, capillaries, smooth muscle cells, endothelial cells, and astrocyte. And these are three different subtypes of NPY receptor, and as you can see, the smooth muscle cell only express the Y1 receptor subtype, which is the one in pil vessel to know that is able to constrict the vessel. We know this is the one that constricts the vessel, okay? But look at the astrocyte here. We've heard a lot about astrocyte expressing lots of receptors for peptide. They express basically three of the six subtype of NPY receptor. So they clearly have a lot of receptors for basically any peptide that you're looking at. Now, this is in culture. Will they do that in vivo? If you look by immunocytochemistry in native tissue, I don't know. But here now, if we take a slice, and this is what we've done with Bruno Colli, if we take a slice, this is a penetrating arterioles, you can see the smooth muscle, and this is the response to NPY. You can see that it vasoconstrict very nicely the vessel. So I think whatever is the mechanism, where are the receptors, if we flush NPY on there, the vessel will constrict. Okay, but again, I don't know exactly where are the receptors. Yes. I can already. Yeah. I mean, I will tell you. All these experiments at the time were done at 20, 25 degrees. Okay, room temperature. So they are all extremely slow. Honestly, the time scale in all the slice that we've done is extremely long.
This is a bath perfusion, though, right?
This is a bath perfusion.
It's going to take a little while to get in.
Yeah, so but that's what here, you know, this is...
You got maybe 50 seconds.
We put it here, you know, and then it goes in. It's coming from the tube, it goes in, and then we actually see the response. This is what we see, very...
Yeah, that, this is so... You think you got a pet right next to your vessel, it might be seconds.
Yeah, we did not. For those ones, they were not pushed into the directly into the cuvette. They were just circulating, replacing the solution that was there. And then at some point, you get probably the, you know, this response. And that was very typical of what we saw by basically superfusing the solution with that. But all, none of the vessels, I'll come back, were pre-constricted. They were all in native condition. I think some groups will pre-constrict the vessels to see dilatation. We've led them to the probably lack of tone to a certain extent, all the vessels. But to constrict, they could clearly constrict because they were, if anything, they were probably dilated already in the slides. Okay? So this is one example again. Just as far as we can say, the vessels have the capacity to respond to acetylcholine or to neuropeptide. Whether this is a direct effect of the NPY on the smooth muscle cells, that I cannot answer because I flushed NPY in the dish and it's presenting a constriction. Is it a direct effect? We assume it is, but at this point, we don't know. This is, however, it's not always that they don't react to everything. So here is for the VIP. VIP is inducing a dilatation, again, here. They don't really come back to their resting tone because they're dilated already. They don't have a tone, but they can dilate to vasoactive intestinal polypeptide. They do express in the smooth muscle cell the receptor VPAC1, which we know are dilator receptors. But again, the astrocyte also express these receptors. Okay, so we don't know if this is a direct effect on the smooth muscle cell or if it has to go to the astrocyte. We don't know that. Okay, but CCK. If we look at CCK, and that was interesting because there was a very old paper in the early 80s, end of 70s, the first paper to show CCK nerve terminals around blood vessel. So we cholecystokinin, okay, cholecystokinin peptide. So when we applied cholecystokinin, we thought we'd get a fabulous response because it was one of the first peptides to actually be described. And as you can see here, no effect whatsoever with CCK, no receptors in the smooth muscle cell, A receptors in the endothelial cell, so is it modulating permeability to the capillary level? This could be a possibility, okay? Astrocyte, however, do have CCK, but even though they do have CCK receptors, there was no vasomotor response at that level, okay? So I think that is telling us there are terminals coming to the microcirculation. These terminals contain vesicles, varicosities that can release things. The receptors are present, and the vessel can respond. Now, nobody so far has been able to show the presence of functional glutamate receptors on brain vessel. Nobody, okay? Even by molecular biology, they always show no expression of the major subunit of the glutamate receptors at that point. And this is probably one of the reasons why glutamate is likely to be acting through the astrocyte.
And it's like the gift for yourself. I mean, there's always chronic inhibition going on in the brain. Right?
Yeah.
So is your sense that the vasculature is always being bathed in these chronic levels of NPY, VIP, and
that would be my guess, because there is a tone to the vessels even in vivo. However, the tone of the vessel is mediated a lot. The intrinsic basal tone of the vessel is a lot through the endothelial cell that release NO, and they also release endothelin 1. So there is a constitutive expression of ENOS and of the synthetic enzyme for endothelin 1 by the endothelial cell to be released on the smooth muscle cell to maintain the basal tone of the vessel. So this is normally how we believe in vascular physiology that the baseline tone is given when we talk at the vessel level. Now, if we're in the brain and you have all of these glutamate, GABA, peptide, acetylcholine mediators, clearly somehow the vessel has to adapt and maintain a tone. What is the most important one in resting condition? Is it the intrinsic capacity of the vessel to synthesize dilators and constrictor over the surroundings in the milieu? I don't know. So when there is a release of something, because there is an activation, and then something is released, then the blood vessel will respond. I think that is likely to be the case. But I think there is already an intrinsic tone given directly by the vascular cell to the vessel, which might be the driving one, actually, at rest. Yes?
I'm trying to understand the thing that you put up to the claim that nobody's seen vectors, but has anybody, does it also include just creating the vessel and moving?
Well, I'm citing here one, you know, one paper where they looked at endothelial cells, looking at messenger RNA of different glutamate receptors that they could not find expression. And this is a review here that I think is also quite interesting if you, you know, want to have a look at that. They looked in many different species, rabbit, rat, cat, cow, and human. They did baiting the vessels with glutamate. They really tried as much as they could to elicit a response to glutamate in isolated vessels, and they were not able to do that. Okay? There is one comment that some people have told, and I think maybe someone is looking into that. If you look at the NMDA receptor, for instance, it needs a release of this serine, maybe, to be, you know, functional. So maybe they need the astrocyte to be activated to release this serine, and then it will be functional. But in isolated vessel, I don't think anybody has tried that combination, as far as I know. Okay? So this is where we are for the glutamate. No direct proof that the vessel has the capacity to respond to glutamate directly. So GABA interneuron, why do I like GABA interneurons? Why do I get interested in the GABA interneuron? It's when we look at the EM and we look at those associations with the blood vessel. What we found was that look at the terminals that contain GAD. GAD is the synthesizing enzyme for GABA, okay? In serial section, you could see lots of them surrounding the vessel, sometimes dendrites being clearly resting on the vessel. So that was interesting because we had never seen another system with so many terminals. But then we kind of woke up. Why? Why is that? Because we looked at GABA here, very well positioned in the cortex to receive afferent input. But they also colocalized NOS, VIP, NPY, somatostatin. Basically, all of the peptide we had been looking at are actually contained within the GABA interneurons. They are different subsets of interneurons. These are not contained in pyramidal cell. They are exclusively contained within the GABA interneurons. Okay? So when we look at those individually, we saw a few terminals. Now if I look at GAD, I can probably look at all of these populations of interneurons around the circulation because they are all GABA interneurons. Okay? And this is one here, a GABA interneuron, which is colocalized nitric oxide, you know, NOS. So clearly they are first of all, well positioned by their role in the cortex, and they contain all of these vasoactive mediators that we looked at. Yes. Yeah, this might be a capillary. Yes. Would be the same. So here, if you had a marker for a pericyte, it could actually be very nice to go in and do double labeling for a marker for a pericyte. I think that would be a way to look into that. Okay. So then, okay, this is when we decided that if we have so much of the GABA innervation around these intracortical vessels, GABA interneurons are known to integrate the afferent input to the cortex and basically to balance cortical activity, oscillation, pyramidal cell output. This is what they do. We know that they are the target for subcortical afferent because they are receiving a lot of terminals from basal forebrain, serotonergic, norepinephrine, a lot of these afferent. So then can they really be influencing the blood vessels themselves if we look at the GABA interneuron? So this is also nice because GABA interneuron can be discriminated by many means. So first of all, they are only 20% of the cell in the cortex, so it's a small population of cell in the cerebral cortex compared to the pyramidal cell. But as you can see here, they have different shapes, different firing pattern, they contain different peptide. So basically you have subpopulation of GABA interneuron and you can discriminate them.
But the so-called fast-spiking cells are not containing these parvalbumin positive.
These will be parvalbumin positive cells, okay? And they would not contain VIP, they would not contain somatostatin. They would not. NPY, somatostatin can colocalize. So I'll show you another slide where there is the anatomy of that. Okay? As a, I mean, there are exceptions, but as a whole, there are very clear families of interneurons. Okay? Based on their firing mode, their shape, and their peptide content.
It could be a little bit, but you said a little bit about
part of the way, if you want fine-tune control of dilation and constriction, you would expect the projections of VIP and some possible words to mean delays in the vascular region. So I'm wondering if there's any knowledge about that.
Okay, to do this, you would have to do here, instead of looking at GAD itself, which is labeling the whole GABA interneuron, we would need to do double labeling or triple labeling. You could label with nitric oxide synthase, NPY, somatostatin, and look at that. Then you would say what is in the surrounding of an arteriole or a capillary, what do I see? Nobody has done that. You know, if you want to go in the micro environment, so small into an arteriole. If you go at the light microscopic level, let's say if this would be a vessel, you would still need to do multiple labeling to label. And then probably I would say, from our experience, and that could be done, when we have, let's say, a small varicosity here, like this brown one, if this would be a vessel, if it is opposed to it, you go to the EM, you would be most likely within that first half micron. So you would be very close to the vessel, okay? So you could probably say if this would be a labeling of different terminals or different subtype of GABA interneurons, looking at the vessel, you could probably go to do triple labeling and say there were so many terminals that contain NOS, so many that contain NPY, but that's a lot of work, but it's feasible. It's feasible. Then you would delineate the microdomains of a vessel in terms of innervation. You know, with fluorescence, confocal, two-photon microscopy, if you have a clear position, change in color, I think you could say that this is very close to this 0.05, 0.25 micron. Yeah. But at the EM, it would be very difficult to do that at the EM. Okay, so this is just to show you another complexity here. I think that's a slide from Freud. I forgot, but I think it is from him, a review from him, where he shows all of these different interneurons. Their firing pattern can be discriminated. But what I think is important is that interneurons are electrically coupled. So they have coupling between subtype. So the fast spiking neurons are coupled together. The VIP neurons are coupled together, but they don't couple to the different population. So that's allow another level of signaling, because if you excite one, they will probably be exciting a population of interneuron. And anatomically, this is probably now what most of the people would actually refer to when we talk about the peptide content. So this is all the GABA interneuron. This is parvalbumin. And as you can see, those are the fast spiking cells. They don't actually contain any of those. No, somatostatin, NPY, NOS, this is one gross population. These would be, those are GABA interneurons as well. This, when we apply NPY, it's constricting. When we apply NPY, they constrict. Somatostatin, when we apply somatostatin, it constricts the vessel, but in a very few vessels. I think we tested 10 vessels. We could see constriction in one vessel when you directly bait the vessel. But what is interesting is that there is a subset of those which are the NOS neuron, which clearly are dilator neuron. So it is not, you know, it is not a very unique situation that you have only constrictors and only dilators. But those one will be constrictor. This is the, yes?
I think first you know, if you go back one slide, the macrom slide.
That one? Oh, it's a macrom? Okay, I thought it was Freud, it's macrom.
Can you make out the class of interneurons that match this sum?
I think to some extent, yes, people have done that. But I mean, this is the neurogliaform is an NPY. You know, it contains NPY. The Bitschuster cell is the VIP, typical VIP cell. Martinotti is a somatostatin cell most of the time. The double bouquet is also a VIP cell. Bipolar also a VIP cell. There will be CAT cell as well, cholinergic cells. No, you absolutely can discriminate them by the firing, the anatomy, and the peptide content in most of the cases. Absolutely. But it's not 100%. They contain more than one sometime. They contain sometimes more than one peptide.
So I have a very stupid question. Yeah, whenever I see this picture, so the neuroglia form cell, is this an astrocyte or is this...
It contains GAD and PY.
Okay, so
it's the shape of it. It is the shape of it that has been referred to as neuroglia form, because they have a very small extension, but very dense extension. They look very much like the astrocyte you're showing us in 3D, but they would not stain for GFAP. Okay? And those are, you know, so you can, yes, you can go and delineate them with peptide with firing mode. So, but I, in this one, they did not, but you could try to do, but there would not be only one peptide there. There would be more than one. So, as you can see here, and VIP CAT cells, the interneurons that contain acetylcholine, are a subset as well of the calreticulin cells. Okay, so it's not, you know, interneurons are basically quite complicated. So in order to assess that, what we've done, we've actually looked in slices. So all of that now is done in slices with no preconstriction in the vessel at room temperature, where we patch neurons, we depolarize a single neuron, and we look at the firing pattern, trying to identify the interneuron by the firing pattern. We aspirated the cytoplasm at the end, and we did PCR to identify the peptide that it contained. And when we were depolarizing the cell, we measured the change in the vessel diameter. Okay? So those are all different cells that were patched around the in that cortical here. So what we found is that, again, we found cells that contained VIP, like this one here, that was dilating vessel. But if you look, the cell contained VIP, but NPY and somatostatin and CCK. It's a very rare proportion of VIP cells that do that, but they do have that. If you look here, this is the cell. Some of them didn't have all of that. They only had VIP. But I'm showing you one example, which was clearly a cell where it was not so easy to know. And it dilated the arteriole. If we look at this one here, this is a cell. This one constricted the vessel. And that one contained somatostatin into its, you know, expression. Okay?
Is this because of the preparation that all these cells that you actually record from are actually close to the vasculature, or do you think that it's farther away on projecting?
Oh, let's say the way we've done that, because we didn't have a look at all, you know, we're limited in the visual field that we had. So we were patching neurons, trying to locate vessels that we could locate in our visual field. If we would be able to actually go larger and then go and scan vessels to see which one have responded, I think it would probably be much more. We didn't find so many cells, probably because we were restricted. We had to find a cell that could induce in a vessel that we had in the field a response. And I think that that is a very important question. It would be nice to do that while you patch a neuron and then you look at all the vessels and see which one is responding. But we may have missed a lot of response because we didn't do that. But I don't know if we would have missed either. Yes?
So, I mean, so I think that the CCK cell, the fact that there was, again, back, the fact that there was no response is basically a statement that
I would say that. I would actually say that GABA itself is not a dilator. I'll come back to that in vivo. I think more and more that GABA itself, even though it has been shown at the peel vessels, at the surface of the cortex, to be a dilator, I think in the intracortical vessel, it's very hard to show that there is a direct dilatory effect of GABA. If so, all the interneurons we would have stimulated would have induced dilation. If GABA would be a potent dilator, I would expect that many more of the interneurons that we stimulated would have induced vasodilatation. Well, our reviews about that, what we actually were explaining at the time is that we were at 20 to 25 degrees room temperature. No preconstriction, no tone in the vessel. So this is slow, but I think in other labs where they have actually looked at vascular response at so low temperature, it's very similar, or in the similar order of magnitude. In the cerebellum, we actually moved the temperature up to 35 degrees in the slice, and it was much faster. But I mean, still, it was in minutes. It was still in minutes. Yes, in the slice. Absolutely. I was not able ever in a slice to stimulate a neuron and see a response in second. Never. In vivo, it's a few seconds. Yeah. Or if you stimulate an afferent and you look at the blood flow response, it can be within a second to a few seconds, you know. Yeah, maybe not in the dilatation or count, but in terms of blood flow response, it could go within a second. Yeah. We depolarize, yes, the neuron. We actually depolarize the neuron for 2 minutes. Okay, so we depolarize the neuron for 2 minutes with burst, and then we followed the vessels and just recorded. And at the end, we just went, and every time point, we did a measurement. Okay, but there was no continuous stimulation for all of that time frame. No, no. Yes.
But question in terms of how interneurons are going to release peptides. Mm-hmm. Sometimes how the peptide release is actually slower.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the fast release is GABAergic, and the peptide release is dense cord vesicles, and takes a longer buildup.
That's
it's
true.
It's not the same fast particular release site. And often involves L-type calcium channels. So, you know, it's possible that there's a differential release pattern that leads to that delayed effect.
Because they come from the dense. Yeah, well.
That is anti-Dale, seeing that, right? But it's, but there's a lot of work in neuroendocrine cells and releasing of dense cord vesicles. And it has a different distribution and a different pattern of release with different patterns of stimulation.
So they are in the dense core vesicle, the peptide, that's for sure. They're not in the small synaptic vesicle that contain GABA or glutamate. They are, no, the
peptide.
They are the big vesicle inside the terminal. So they are different from the one that contains glutamate or GABA.
Or GABA.
Yeah.
Not the small GABAergic vesicles that can be identified. This is in a different vesicle.
But it's more than that. I would say it's very, I think, people showing in vivo release of peptide has been very difficult in the cortex. So I
don't know what I mean. So during the normal, so understand what's being said, you're saying that during the sort of normal tonic firing by inhibitory interneurons, you may not be getting release of dense cord vessels, and it could be particular to burst of firing or
If you do have, I don't, you know, you will not get release of the peptide if you don't have very, probably high depolarization of the cell. I think that's probably sure.
It's different than the fast vesicular release at the active zone.
But it's like a basic experiment that has to be done. How to apply the inhibitory cell to get release of that cord vessel as opposed to get release of gamma.
Yes.
Yes.
So then you need a microdialysis probe that will actually be able to measure the peptide and GABA.
Sure,
I think.
I can't think of a lot of work where people looked at peptide release from interneurons.
No. It's very, very difficult.
But they, you know, people have shown they have the dense cord vesicles, they have peptides, they can get peptides released, but the fast analysis of the impact of peptide release from this type of neuron, I think this is one of the few cases of that.
Yeah, and I mean, and even I'm not.
If you have other cells with dense cord vesicles, which are the neuroendocrine cells, it's a different pattern, right? So some of these cells have also similar dense cord vesicles. And,
so it is not clear how the peptides are released, absolutely not. And I mean, I am not. Yeah, and I think. No, I think it's very important. Absolutely, it's very. And I don't, even though those neurons did that. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yes. Yeah, there is one paper from Fergus and Lee in the 1997, I think, where they applied GABA in a slice of cortex, and they didn't see dilatation in the cortical vessel. They saw dilatation in the superficial vessel.
So the in-vivo response were all on the order of seconds. here in minutes, but these are the deep vessels, and all the in vivo stuff.
I wouldn't. Yeah, and I wouldn't pay too much attention to the time because of the way that I think the experiments were not designed.
It's still inconsistent because it could be that all those fast responses are due to direct GABA responses, which only occur at the surface.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
I don't think that these local vasodilatation or will be due to the release of GABA on the large vessels. No. Yes, and we did not measure that, so I cannot even tell you if the dilatation here is mated by VIP. In order to do that, we would need to add an antagonist to the VPAC1 receptors. Then I could see clearly VIP is involved in that response because I can block the effect by an antagonist of the receptor. Okay, so I think that is something I cannot say. Even here, somatostatin, where it constricts, I could have to really go and prove it's somatostatin mediated. I think we would need to put a somatostatin receptor antagonist to prove that. Yes?
Well, you're fairly confident that the dilation and contraction is not due to GABA.
Let's say more and more from what we do in vivo, I don't think that GABA would be mediating both a dilation and a constriction, first of all. And I don't think that if it would be GABA, I stimulated hundreds of, hundred and I don't know how many GABA cells, interneurons. If GABA would be the dilator or the constrictor, I should have seen much more cells than we did see. This is a gut feeling. I have no proof of that. But I believe if it would be GABA, I should have seen repetitively that there would be a response. We did not either test that, no. We did not change the frequency of stimulation. We didn't change the time. We set it up at, I would have to go back in terms of Hertz, but so 2 minutes, and always the same type of pattern for every interneuron type that we stimulated, basically. Yeah.
So I know, just last question, but
no, it's
the,
good.
The effect of the, if you stimulate, you must have stimulated the parvalbumin cells that have no peptides.
I don't think I had any parvalbumin cells because those are very easy to recognize. They're very big. They're very easy to know. We were looking for the one we knew had vasomotor effect that we were aware of because anatomically we can know if they're bipolar. We can see them in the infrared. So we didn't. I don't think I had. I would have to go back, but I don't think I had parvalbumin positive cell, actually.
Because GABA is also going to activate astrocytes.
Yes.
And then yes. It'll affect the whole network. So
that's what I think it's doing. This is what I think more and more that GABA is doing. It's acting through non-vascular cells. Absolutely. So this is Rossido, just to show you. I don't think I need to show these videos. And this is one thing I wanted to show here. This is the cell we looked at by infrared. This is the vessel that constricted. The cell is labeled here. And it contains somatostatin. In that case, does it have parvalbumin? You see, it doesn't have parvalbumin. Okay, so to answer your question, Brian, that one doesn't have parvalbumin. Okay, here. So, and we noted hotspot. So that's something that we always observe in constriction. Most of the vessel seem to constrict at specific area, like if there were sphincter of smooth muscle cell. Very rarely we had the whole vessel constricting. Maybe like you could show with the astrocyte when you cage calcium, the whole vessel constricted. In our study, it was a local vasoconstriction most of the time. Yes, there was a.
So in the last slide, you had, and also in this slide, you had examples where you had both dilatory signal and inhibitory signal.
Yeah.
Can you give us a sense of whether one signal is more dominant than another? Does dilation always override in contraction?
I wouldn't be able to say that. Here it's a somatostatin cell, does not contain VIP. It doesn't contain no NPY. It does not contain nitric oxide synthase either. I don't think
this
so.
This one constricts, but in your previous slide.
In the previous one, this one here was a NPY NOS, typical of a NOS cell, okay? And in that case, that cell dilated.
And you also have VIP cells.
Yeah,
cell.
That's it. But this one was a NOS cell and it dilated, even though it contained NPY. Okay,
so
I think I wouldn't want to say that. I don't think I would like to say that it would dominate over one response. I don't think so. So this is just to show you again where these cells go, and it seems to have a hot spot area where they would constrict. This is another constriction right here. So what I think if... Yeah, this is a vessel here, which is the same vessel here that I'm looking here. This is a slide from Harrison. I think he had done beautiful cast where he shows the sphincter. So he shows these cells that kind of wrap at the ramification branches where he believes tone can be actually controlled. And we looked at that, they look quite similar to some of the cells that we could see that were actually constricting. I think I have the video of that one. Let's see. Yeah, just to see. Okay. So this is this cell here that we're looking at, and you can see it is at that level only, or mainly, that we could see a change in the diameter here, where there was possibly at the branching some of these type of cells that seems to wrap the vessel differently.
So what is the expression profile of this cell?
What is the
expression profile?
That one, I didn't have it. No. Yeah, some of the PCR we couldn't do on some of the cells. The firing, however, was a regular spiking. But if we go by... Oh, no, it shows here. Type somatostatin for the firing, and the PCR is somatostatin. But I didn't put the... But some cells, I didn't have the PCR. Yes? This is this cell here. Oh, this is, yeah, from Harrison, where he has put cast again, and at multiple places where there are branching of the arteries, he reported the presence of these cells circling around in another dimension. And he called them sphincter, smooth muscle cell, because he believed that they are very important in basic controlling the diameter of the vessel at specific point. And that was reported a long time ago. In a lot of anatomical papers, that you had sphincters in specific points in arterioles. So I think he did it with a cast, which was nice. But if you look at anatomy, people had already reported there was a sphincter in the circulation. Yes?
So, I know this is reported, but I have a problem with this. So, on the one hand, if we're told the smooth muscles electrically are connected by fast arteries, and on the other hand, you do have something which is extraordinarily tight. I mean that gap is the gap on the arrows is sub-micron. And how could it be that you have smooth muscle cells that are many, many microns, and on the other hand you have something so sharp? And how could it be on the top of the... This is not your work, it's Harrison's work.
Yeah.
How could it be that you have this thing wrapping around, but it's still cast? And the cast has come from inside the lumen. So then the claim is that the stuff is somehow going from inside the lumen into whatever that little thing is that's wrapping around it.
It's chewed up.
Yeah, but I think when it's...
Yeah, but it's chewed.
No, but I think when they feel, the cast, and here, I mean, I would have to go back to see what was that. That he believes is the location of other of these cells that would be surrounded.
This is gold coat.
No, what about the one on the bottom? What about the one on the
bottom? That's right, this is gold coat, so you can see things that remain attached after, you know,
but
away. But you coat it with gold or any other metal, and you see them on the cell.
So, no, because you left some schmutz behind, and you coated it with gold.
Yeah, but you have to be able to fix that.
Can you reconcile this claim, right? Part of the same paper that claims that you have something the size of a softball, which you don't have any microvasculature in cortex, with anything that you've seen in your laboratory that has to do with the constriction of the vessel.
What I can say, you know, what we saw is that we saw a lot of the constriction being localized at a very specific area. But maybe, no, because the cell here is larger than 1 micron for sure, you know, for sure. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would be very...
So if we look at another one here.
I will show you
hundreds of these pictures, and you will be able to maybe dive a little bit more into the reasons why they appear in this class.
Okay, so that would be
the phenomenon. And this phenomenon on the bottom is probably a very strange artifact because you find these constriction sites in these preparations. It's really rare.
Okay. So then you believe that this is what
full of artifacts.
Okay.
I would take out that
statement from Arison. Okay. But I think it's fun because I think when we saw that, we went back into other anatomical studies and there was mention of sphincter cell, you know, a lot actually. Specific one.
They don't reconcile
with a smooth muscle. Okay.
Opposite that thing because you would never have what kind of structure would that be that is so extremely sharp getting the vessel.
I have to say I believe I believe what is the scale here must be 10-15 micron. You know, the scale must be 10-15 micron, I believe, something like that, 20 at the most. So you're talking a few micron,
yeah.
A few micron. Yes. Yeah.
Could that sphincter actually be a small part of the larger cell or
they do go in the opposite way. I think, you know, that has been shown before. But if this is way too small to be in any way a smooth muscle cell, then I don't know if, you know, if Bruno says it's an artifact, I mean, I don't know, but it's possible. If you never see this in any of your reconstitution of the vascular network.
You can talk about it more, it's a whole thing.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, this is not my work, so I cannot really tell you what it did exactly. But we kind of felt it mimicked very well, or it could explain very well the fact that we had very localized vasoconstriction. Now, maybe it's something else than this element, but there seems to be something that allows to do that. This is a possibility that you do have localized receptors, but again, nobody has shown that. But we can say yes, but nobody has shown that, really. So it's difficult to tell what it is that does that. So one of the explanations we gave was those sphincter-like of structure, but there might be others, absolutely. So I think if we want any way to be critical about the slice preparation, I think what we know is that activation of single interneuron can elicit changes in the microvessel to which they seem to be connected by anatomy. However, the identity of the mediator is unknown. Even though the cell contains VIP, somatostatin, or something else, I did not do any experiment to say that the response was really VIP-mediated or somatostatin-mediated, because then you need pharmacology to do that in the slice. So we don't know what is the real mediator. And again, I think it would be nice, nobody has done that, but to do antipolarized pyramidal cells, to see when you do that to pyramidal cells, will you get vasomotor responses? I think that could be interesting as well. So this is, I think, the limit of the slice in terms of what we can conclude, except to say that you can get vasomotor responses. And I think, here again, a slide that I think David showed yesterday, where we did not disregard the astrocyte. We put the astrocyte from day one, because they contain the same receptors, or a lot of receptors, that these neurons will actually be releasing. So they contain receptors for GABA, for NPY, for somatostatin. So we don't know if those could be involved in the response either. Okay. So if I just want to go a little bit in vivo, and I think this is why it's important to move from the slice to try to see in vivo what we can conclude. Okay. And this is why I'm starting to believe that GABA is really not acting directly on the blood vessel. Okay. So when we look at imaging that uses blood flow increases to actually map neural activity, what we're doing, I think that's a very nice slide here, where they show a memory tag. By doing that, they were able to map the parahippocampal region, some area other area, and then going to the cortical region. We're mapping pathways. We're mapping processing in the brain, whether it's the whole pathway that can be mapped, or at the level of the cortex, if we're looking at language or at tactile stimulation. So what are we looking at? We're looking at functional anatomy, basically. The neural pathways that we are mapping. And as was shown yesterday, I think, or suggested by Martin's presentation, what is important, it seems, is the local processing within the area where there is an activation. So what can we look at in vivo? How far can we go in vivo, trying to see if the interneurons would be actually involved in the response there? So we have to understand the network again, okay? And then we can see from the network that is activated to a specific afferent pathway, how can we test that it is actually relevant to the blood flow response pharmacologically? So one system that we have used, and this is the work by these three persons in the lab here, is the well-known whisker stimulation, where we know that, you know, this is work from Sokolov, a single whisker will light up a single barrel in terms of glucose, you know, increase. And this is a slide I took from the work of Berkowitz, showing that, again, you can have a beautiful map of the change in the perfusion. But what are the cells that are actually activated when we look at that change in perfusion? So this is what, and I'm going to maybe not talk about that depending on the time, but we could discuss it if time, you know. We have this system here, which is the basal forebrain, which I taught at the beginning, which is very nice. It is also a system that has been used a lot in neuroacid coupling, where you stimulate the basal forebrain. It projects cortical projection to the cortex, so acetylcholine is released there, and it increases blood flow in the cerebral cortex very nicely, and you have a map of the intensity of the perfusion change that have been done. So this is another system that we can use as well. So, and this is what we're looking at. If I have time, I'll show thalamus and basal forebrain, but I'll show the thalamus input by the whisker. We're looking at the integration of the afferent projecting into the cortical, let's say the barrel cortex, and targeting interneurons, pyramidal cell astrocytes, and maybe blood vessel. So what are the neurons that are activated that can actually be explaining the perfusion change? So what we've done for the whisker, we've actually stimulated awake rats, so they were restrained slightly, and they were stimulated in a way. Then we waited and we perfused the animal to identify the neurons that were activated using CFUS as a marker of neural activity. Okay? Yeah, CFUS has, you have to know what you're looking at when you look at CFUS. It doesn't go up in all neurons that you activate. Absolutely, it is, that's for sure. If you see a CFUS positive cell, you can say this cell has been activated. If you don't see a CFUS positive cell, it is not necessarily that it was not activated. But you have to be mainly very careful that your animals are manipulated in a way that don't get CFUS all over the place, because it's a very responsive immediate early gene. So then what we've done, we've double labeled the cell for nuclei, which is CFUS positive, and the markers of the interneurons that we had identified that could be producing vasomotor responses. I would like to note, however, that nobody has been able to use CFUS as a marker of astroglial activation. So I think nobody has been able to show that CFUS is increased into an astrocyte or a microglial cell. It really seems to be a neuronal marker. Okay? And then we can do pharmacology, trying to see if there is implication of GABA or glutamate or peptide into the evoked changes in cerebral blood flow. What we used was laser Doppler. So then we have no very fine resolution. We're looking at the overall blood flow increase into the somatosensory cortex or the barrel cortex. So I don't have a map of the change in blood flow, which would be very precise. It's a global change in blood flow. So if we look at the anatomy, however, of the stimulation of the whisker, I think very nicely, you can see here that you have the barrel very nicely lighted up with CFUS in layer 4, layer 2, 3, and 5, and 6. So I think that's a very nice indication that the barrel column here is activated, and we get very few CFOS on the ipsilateral side. So there is, anatomically, we can actually identify the barrel cortex there. Okay? Now, what are the cells that are CFOS positive? Yes? This was done 1 hour after, but you could actually start seeing the protein about 15 minutes. They are put in the cage and they are left quiet. Yes? They use their whisker all the time, yes. So the animal is awake, but you actually go and stimulate at a very precise, you know, frequency the whisker for about 20 minutes. This was three, C1, C2, C3, that you stimulate. And if actually you were to look at the whole section, you only have these barrels that are activated. So it is not, probably the fact that they go back into their cage and they may be whiskering, you know, on their own, the time is probably different that we don't see these other barrel. And they are cut, actually. The other whiskers are cut. We only keep C1, C2, C3. So they are cut, okay? So there might be a small contribution from their own whisker, whisking during that time, okay? And if we look at the cells that express CFOS, so this is here COX-2, which is known to be a specific subtype of pyramidal cell. And you can see here very nice COX-2 positive cells. VIP cells are COX-2 positive, I mean CFOS positive in some of them. The CAT cells, I don't know why the image is doing that. It's really the first time I have shifted in my image like that. So we have CAT cells that also are CFOS positive. I don't know why. No, it has been doing it since the beginning, so I don't know. And here, if you have the somatostatin cell, you can see none of the somatostatin cells are actually CFOS positive in that stimulus. So when we count the cell, COX-2 pyramidal cells are selectively activated on the contralateral side, VIP cells, CAP, no somatostatin, no NOS, no parvalbumin cell. Okay? But even the parvalbumin cell by Steiger has shown that when he put the rat into a new environment where they whisker, they actually have parvalbumin cells that are activated. But here the mice, the rats, were actually not moving and exploring. They were just quiet, they had been trained for a week, and only were their whiskers stimulated. So maybe depending on how you stimulate the whisker, if the animal is walking around, stimulating the whisker by himself, it may be totally different. Oh yeah, yes, I'll show you another stimulus where somatostatin and NOS cells are CFOS positive. It is actually going up, absolutely, no problem. So this is really, I think, is important. It is really specific to the stimulus that you gave. And you could get the parvalbumin positive if your rat would be exploring the environment and whisking his whisker himself. So I think it's very important to see how you define your paradigm of stimulation. Okay? So I would just like that we remember that here. When we actually stimulate the whisker, and animals, as I said, are immobilized, they are not walking, they are not exploring, they are just having their whiskers stimulated, they are not stressed, they've been acclimatized to us for a week, so they really are just very quiet, and then we release glutamate, we activate these cells, and these specific interneurons. So our question was then, is GABA released and involved in the perfusion response? Is VIP and acetylcholine released and involved in the perfusion response? And what about COX-2 pyramidal cell that can release actually the PGE2 compound? So, and this is just to show you a very nice paper. Actually, I think it's a very nice piece of work from the group of Peterson, that Gentet et al. That came out this summer, where they actually see exactly the same thing. When the mouse, the rat, is whisking, the actually non-FS interneurons are firing and they are inhibiting the fast-spiking parvalbumin neuron, as shown here. So this is very similar to what we see here, that those non-fast-spiking cells, among which VIP neurons are actually part of, and the parvalbumin are inhibited most likely by the VIP interneuron. So I think that's a very interesting paper to look at for the whisker network into the cortex in awake animal. This was all done in awake animal.
But
you know? Yes.
So let's say
I only know this neuron is activated by whiskey. When its VIP is released, then is it going to have an effect on neurons, on astrocyte, on vessel? That's the question, basically. Okay. So this is on the, when they're not actually whisking, these FS cells fire very rapidly. So I think that's very interesting. So there is an inhibition from the VIP neuron on these fast spiking cells that we see actually with the C5. So this is the pharmacology that we've been trying to look at to see, are they involved in the perfusion response in vivo? So we did the whisking, all whiskers at time to get a good increase in blood flow. We look at the increase in the somatosensory cortex by laser Doppler. So this is the response that you do have on the contralateral side, very small response on the ipsilateral side. Then we injected a vehicle, and then we injected the drug. And then we measured the change, the differences in between the vehicle and the antagonist that we've used. All animals were maintained stable. Blood pressure was monitored. As Martin said yesterday, blood gases were also measured. And all of those were taken into consideration. Okay, so just this glutamate is being released in the cortex. We compared two different ways of actually giving a GABA antagonist. So we looked at pyrotoxin because we said those GABA interneurons are activated. Do they release GABA, and is GABA contributing somehow into the blood flow response? So we injected the animal either with pyrotoxin in the cisterna magna. So all of those are intact cranial window. We don't have a cranial window. It's intact skull. The injection is into the cisterna magna, so it is actually diffusing. But we also compared with a topical superfusion into a cranial window. So we compared the two different modes of applying pyrotoxin, and we saw that there was about a 30 to 35% implication. So that tells me somehow there is a GABA-A phenomenon that is involved into the cerebral blood flow response. So GABA-A receptors are activated. Are they on neurons? Are they on astrocytes? Are they on vessel? There are GABA-A that are involved, which is not surprising in a way. You're activating a pathway, you activate interneurons, they release GABA, and this actually is involved into the perfusion response. We actually apply the antagonists about 20 minutes before we do the stimulation. Then we do the stimulation of the whisker, and then we measure again. So I think that's in this slide here. So we do a first stimulation in naive animals with nothing. Then we inject intracisternally the vehicle of pyrotoxin of any other drug. And then we remeasure the blood flow response. And then, yes? I don't know. I wish I knew.
You know, David Edwards showed that the pericytes express GABA-A receptors.
Smooth muscle cells, so according to some people, would have GABA-A receptors. Pericyte may have GABA-A receptors. Astrocyte do have GABA-A receptors. Neurons do have GABA-A receptors. So, in a way, it is not surprising that by blocking GABA-A receptors, all of these may be involved. I think it's not possible to say which one. But there is an implication of GABA-A receptors in the network. I think we're looking at network.
See, though, if you put a pyrotoxin, you would expect the activity of nerve cells to go up and a greater cerebral blood flow increase. So it's kind of counterintuitive for the neuronal component.
If you do, if you would have an increase in cortical activity and cerebral blood flow, you probably have blocked the GABA-A receptors so much that you've got an epileptic type of activity. That's probably what I would suspect. So when we actually monitored the EEG in all of the rats, there was no epileptic activity. So we were not at a dose that would actually be inducing or blocking all the GABA-A receptors so that you would have increased cortical activity to a point. So this is, I agree with you, it's totally counterintuitive. I absolutely agree with you. Okay. So this tells somehow that there is a GABA-A contribution into the pathway. Then we looked at NMDA receptors, because we saw that pyramidal cells that contain COX-2 were also activated, so they are pyramidal cells, they may release glutamate. And we looked at the NMDA receptors. Here, we can see about 40% decrease when we put the MK801 antagonist. What was interesting is that when we combined the two, picrotoxin plus NMDA receptors, we actually had an additive effect, suggesting that somehow we have both excitatory and inhibitory pathways that are involved into this response. Where are the receptors? I don't know. If they are on the vessels, on the neurons, on the astrocyte, they're probably everywhere. Okay? So clearly there is an inhibition of these pathways by GABA and glutamate pathways. We tried antagonists to acetylcholine because CAT interneurons were activated. So we've blocked the muscarinic acetylcholine receptors. No effect. No effect on the blood flow. No decrease on the blood flow. We blocked the VIP receptors with two different VIP antagonists. No effect. Okay? So muscarinic acetylcholine receptor had been shown by Sokolov in the early 90s that they would not decrease the blood flow response to whisker stimulation. So basically, we confirmed that. So we totally agree with his findings, and we could not show VIP. This is why, at that point, I have a tendency to believe that the peptides, if they modulate, if they are involved in the blood flow response or in the vasomotor response, are probably doing it very locally. In using laser Doppler, if there is very local release of the peptide, we probably cannot pick it up, because I think this is a possibility. And I think people doing two photon that can look at many vessels around the perfusion chains in the core of the response, you might be able to do that. But I think with laser Doppler, if there are peptide effects, we could not pick them up.
What is the spatial resolution of laser Doppler?
It's about 1 millimeter, cubic millimeter. Okay, so, and I'm at the surface of the bone, which has been thinned quite a lot. So I believe I'm taking up the CBF response in the layer 1, 2, 3, maybe upper layer 4, but not in the deeper layers. Okay, I think that's probably a safe statement. So I think if these peptides would be involved in the change in the vessel at, in those layers, if it they would be important, we should see it, actually. Okay. What about the COX? Okay? So we showed that there was a very strong activation of the COX-2 pyramidal cell. Okay? So I'm very sorry that my figures, which I think are very nice normally, have been torsion, you know, they go into a very distortion. So yeah. But that's okay. So what we've done, we've actually looked at indomethacin as a non-selective COX blocker, COX-1 and COX-2. Okay? So if we do that, if we block with endomethacin, we lose about 50% of the response. And that had been shown before, so we agree with those findings. NS-398, which is a selective COX-2 inhibitor, again, about 50% of the response. That agrees very well with the group, actually, of the study by Niwa and Iadecola, where they use COX-2 knockout mice. So when they use COX-2 knockout mice, they actually lost about 50% of the cerebral blood flow response to whisker stimulation, as well as when they use the same antagonist here in the mouse. And that was done into the rat as well. This is in the group of Alfonso Silva, where they also use the NS-398 COX-2 selective inhibitor. So that is telling us that yes, COX-2 are actually involved into the perfusion response. Okay? When we try COX-1, we could not see any COX-1 effect, if I just put it here. So COX-1 in our hand had no effect. That is also the case in the Iadecola group. When they use a COX-1 knockout mouse, there was no effect on the induced blood flow response to whisker stimulation. And they also have used this compound. So basically, we confirmed the same data that they had in the mouse. We confirmed them in the rat. I just would like to show here a slide by, again, the group of Iadecola. Those are COX-2 nerve terminals from pyramidal cells around blood vessels. So there is the machinery for nerve terminals to release here the PGE2 vasoactive molecule, most likely directly from these neurons if they are activated. Then we were actually, we had lots of debate with my friend here, Brian, because Brian really is talking about the COX-1. So, you know, I think we should, this, you know, I think we have, here it's a nice place to actually bring that up. We did PCR in astrocyte, trying to see if they would express COX-1 or COX-2. So this is this, the astrocyte that have been labeled here with the SR101 compound that we've heard this morning about in a slide. And this is a pyramidal site, the pyramidal cell in the slide. So they were both patched, and we performed PCR. So as you can see here in the astrocyte, GFAP is present, the S100 beta is present in the cell, COX-1 here is not present, but I will come back to that, and COX-2 is not present. When we look in the pyramidal cells, we took the V-glutamate transporter 1 as a marker of glutamate neurons, and the COX-2 here is present. So what we show is that in the 20 cells that we patch, either pyramidal cells or astrocyte, COX-2 was in a proportion of about 40% of the pyramidal cells. Okay? And this is where we do immuno for COX-1. So this is also something I think we can discuss a lot, because immuno for COX-1 in our hand is labeling the microglial cell. Okay? Brian sees it in the astrocyte, as well as the group of Nedergaard, they also see it in the astrocyte. In our hand, we don't see it in the astrocyte, we see it in the microglia. But then we went further down, and here this is again, just to show the complete set here. Yeah, well, I'm sorry, it's not my fault, you know. So, but just... sorry about that. Bruno, I'm sorry, because Bruno has done beautiful work for that. I'm very sorry for him. So Halloween is in the weekend. So, but here, just to say that this is here in astrocyte that doesn't show COX-1. But we had COX-1 in about 10% of the astrocyte in messenger RNA. Okay? So maybe they have the capacity then to express the protein in a subset of astrocyte. I think this is possible. In our hand, the messenger RNA was not found commonly in a lot of astrocytes, and we never found COX-2 in any of the astrocytes. So I think the signal, the message here, I think, is that if we do have a COX-2 effect, it has to be neuronal, because there is COX-2 is clearly in the pyramidal cell, but it is not in the astrocyte. I think Brian would agree with that, that COX-2 is not in the astrocyte. We have no COX-1 effect in that specific stimulus. But again, Yadekola has shown that COX-1 could be involved when he has hypercapnia in his animal. It seemed that then COX-1 could be involved. So would that be a glial effect at that level in specific condition? That is a possibility. I think at that point it's open. But in that specific whisker to barrel pathway, there is no COX-1 that we can or others have been able to really delineate. So it is a neuronal COX-2 contribution. Okay. I will finish, I think, with this EATS, because the EATS are the known, probably the best known dilators coming out of astrocyte at this point. Okay, they are derived from arachidonic acid through this CYPT, you know, this enzyme here, this epoxygenase, and they synthesize the EATS that then can dilate, and they will diffuse and dilate the smooth muscle. As we mentioned, COX-2 would not lead to PGE2, but maybe there is a subset of astrocyte that will be actually synthesizing PGE2 through COX-1 enzyme here. So looking at these heats, and again, this was shown already by many other people that these heats were involved, okay? So we just wanted to see if GABA or glutamate would also be interacting with the EATS. So we can block the heats with this inhibitors here of this enzyme, or you can also block it by blocking the receptor of the EATS. It's a subset of receptor of the EATS. And is GABA, could GABA and glutamate, both of them, act through the astrocyte? Glutamate has been shown to actually activate metabotropic receptors on the astrocyte that would release then these EATS and induce a vasodilatation. That has been the pathway that has been shown by Zonta et al., that has been shown by other groups into this somatosensory cortex. So we were asking, could GABA also be acting through the astrocyte? So this is again the same here. We use fluorocitrate. Fluorocitrate is an inhibitor of glial or astrocytic metabolism. It's a dirty compound. I think you just basically inhibit the activity, metabolic activity of the astrocyte. But then we compare that with this MSPPOH antagonist or inhibitors here, and we do see the same inhibition. So we lose about 40% of the evoked CBF response, which is totally in line with what the group of Raymond Kohler has been reported and other group have been reported. To our surprise, however, when we ask if glutamate or GABA would be involved, the group of Kohler had shown that glutamate would be acting through these heads. And I think this is, we confirm that by using the, actually, in that case, MK801, we have no additive effect. But I'm very sorry, it's very difficult to read. I'm apologizing about that. But in our case, GABA-A receptor blockade was not additive to blocking the astrocyte either. So, one question is that, could GABA-A receptors on astrocyte be inducing calcium transient and then activating this, the cascade of the EATS? I wish somebody would do that. Yes, there is a question here. I think we did 20 minutes, 40 minutes, 60 minutes, and I think around 50 minutes to 6 is about the best time. When we inject it in the cisterna magna to see that effect. I think from what we read in the literature, this is about the good time. 1 hour seems to be blocking probably as much as you can get in terms of astroglial metabolism at this point. It's blocking one of the enzymes in the Krebs cycle of the astrocyte. So you're not selectively, you're blocking all astrocytic function at that point. I think at the dose that we use and from the literature, it should not be affecting the neuron. But I mean, I didn't check any neuronal function or neuronal effect there. But based on this concentration, the time, it doesn't seem to be affecting neurons at that point. Okay? It's been used, you know, very, very much so for a lot of things, and nobody has, I think, ever shown that there was neuronal effect on that. But it's very widely used in vitro in the slice and in vivo as well, in many, many pathways. So I think it has the, you can blame that it's a very non-selective blockers of astroglial metabolism. But if you look at an astrocytic function, you can start there. And then if there is an effect, you can start to then dissect it out, like we did with MSPPOH. Okay.
So I wanted to go back to the slide with the graph, the bar charts.
Bar charts.
Showing us the summary here. So you have.
So this is about the same. Yeah,
so
for
have,
us.
You have the MK801, and you have the picrotoxin, and the. Oh, here.
Yeah. So MSPPOH alone blocks about 40%.
But so the MK801 effect is also, isn't it the same as the COX-2 effect, too, right? You're proposing that this is.
We did not combine those, actually. No,
well,
we did not.
That would be a neuronally mediated response. So.
Well, I mean, MK201 would block NMDA receptors, which would be not maybe only neuronal. You don't have only neuronal NMDA receptors. But obviously, they would likely be neuronal. Yes, I agree. But here, this is why I think it is interesting, because the picrotoxin as well, which is blocking about 30% or 20-something, is clearly not significantly additive. So, and that was shown for the metabotropic glutamate receptors, it is not additive either. So it seems that the glutamate pathway somehow is merging into the astrocyte, somehow. And here the GABA-A receptors seems to do the same as well.
I mean, so, I think it's interesting. It's really hard to see the EAT effect in a brain slice by activating astrocytes.
That's interesting, and because in vivo, everybody sees it.
So
in vivo.
This is a discrepancy, a puzzle. I don't understand.
Because, I mean, the EAT effect was shown by, I think first was shown by the group of Kohler in the somatosensory cortex. Then it was repeated by several other groups. Basically, we were just using it as a classic contributor to the perfusion response. So this is interesting that in the slice, you don't see it, but you say that it's inhibited maybe through the NO, through the 20 EATS, that may be inhibiting that. That has been shown by David Kohler as well in vivo.
And Eric Newman in the retina.
So I think you can probably modulate that, but if you don't manipulate the system, I think this is very well in line, 40 to even 50 and 60% in some people.
A difference here, of course, you have anesthetic too.
They are urethane.
Anesthetic is also altering the pattern responses too.
They are urethane anesthetized for all the pharmacology, absolutely. Yeah, but this, I think, you know, the group of Raymond Kohler does use, I think, chlorellose, and he sees the same contribution. So I think in vivo, I think that's a very robust contribution. The question is that really now an astroglial component? Some people are raising the question whether this cytochrome P450 epoxygenase is exclusive to the astrocyte. The original work by David Harder and Alcade was in astrocyte cell culture. So I think a lot of people want to revisit that to see if in vivo they would find this enzyme in other compartment than in the astrocyte. But at this point, nobody has actually done that. So it is so far attributed to an astrocytic compartment. So if I just want to close on that, and I don't think I will go into, due to the time, to the basal forebrain, I could mention just two things with the basal forebrain. So if we actually try to summarize the network that we've been able to activate by CFOS, so you activate through the whisker these thalamocortical afferents. They will then project to interneurons, to probably, you know, a lot of cells in the cortex. But when we use CFOS, what we can see is that the VIPCAT interneurons are the ones that get activated through CFOS, okay? These neurons being activated, they may then release GABA, possibly enact on the astrocyte. Will that trigger calcium transient and the release of EADS? That is one possibility that we saw with the picrotoxin. It would suggest that this is a possible way of releasing EADS on the vessel. Here, the presence of GABA-A receptors on blood vessel, as I said, even though it was shown in the surface vessel, the actual evidence of a direct vasodilatory effect on the cortical microvessel from the work of Fergus and Lee in 1997 seems to say that it is probably not the case, suggesting that it is probably then GABA is acting through other means to dilate the vessel. That might be one. Then these cells here that are activated will inhibit those fast-spiking parvalbumin cells, which are the main inhibitors of the pyramidal cell. Normally, these are the ones that gate the pyramidal cell's output. So by inhibiting these cells, actually, then we increase. So this is probably why, you know, the picrotoxin has an effect on the blood flow, because we're shortcutting here that effect. These cells are disinhibited, and then they will actually act through metabotropic receptors, likely through EADS. What about NMDA receptors on astrocyte? They exist. Will they also be contributing to this heat? I think the pharmacological data seems to say it's a possibility. And we also have here the COX-2 pyramidal cell that will get disinhibited and activated, and they could release PGE2. They have receptors on the vessels for PGE2 to increase blood flow. So I think it's very hard to clearly say that those VIP or acetylcholine release on the activated interneurons are directly involved into the response, unless, as I say, if there is local contribution that we were not, in measuring global blood flow, able to see it. And in that specific pathway, it seems that there is at least two pyramidal cell markers. Glutamate is a main one, and the COX-2 releasing PGE2 is another main contributor in the blood flow response. So the GABA, I think, is really acting through modulation of the neuronal circuitry. I don't think I have time to go to the basal forebrain, but I will go to just one slide, if you want. Can I?
Yeah, it's okay.
I don't know. I didn't keep track of the time.
No, no,
because you were asking about, can the somatostatin cell actually be activated?
Yeah.
And I think that was one of our main questions, actually. So when we did that for the basal forebrain, so the basal forebrain is releasing acetylcholine throughout the cortex. And then when you look at those, we actually can see activation of pyramidal cells again. This is a ubiquitous marker for pyramid. This is COX-2. And this is here GABA interneurons. And in that specific stimulus, What we see is another family of interneuron, which is activated. It's the somatostatin NPY, but the VIP and CAP are not activated significantly. There is a small activation, but it is not significant compared to the contralateral side. So that is telling us that it is clearly is input specific. You activate the neuronal secretory depending on the neurotransmitter that you release in the cortex.
So, I mean, this is a very effective way of activating somatostatin.
This is a very good way of activating somatostatin cell. Basal forebrain. Basal forebrain. Cholinergic system.
In this case, this is a way to sort of highlight somatostatin in the neurons, but having a highly trained neuron stimulating the whiskers would be a very effective way of stimulating the other. So,
if you have... Yeah, if you want to activate your VIP neuron, you stimulate the whisker.
Yeah.
If you want to activate your somatostatin neuron, you actually increase the cholinergic tone. And then the somatostatin cell will be activated. And very, very, almost no VIP cell. So then you can discriminate exactly. Yes?
But then again, they are so separated away. You want to have a role for the neurons in terms of, again, fine-tuning tones.
But they are far away.
I mean, what you show right now that you activate the whisker, you get the VIP to increase.
Yeah. But you can, yeah, but you can do, you can activate the whisker under a cholinergic tone. Okay? You can facilitate, which is what you do when you pay attention, when you stimulate the basal forebrain. And then that would be something to look at. That would be something to look at. Or pharmacologically, you can induce acetylcholine release, or because, I mean, this has been shown in electrophysiology that acetylcholine would facilitate the thalamocortical, the somatosensory input. So I think you could then probably look and see if you would activate the VIP neurons at that point or facilitate that. I think there is possibility to look into that because electrophysiologically, you facilitate by giving acetylcholine, you facilitate the sensory information in terms of electrophysiology. So will it be translated into increasing or showing CFOS in the VIP neurons? That would be something to look into it, okay? And somatostatin, you know, we showed in the whisker barrel that if you block muscarinic receptor, you don't have any influence on the blood flow. In this one, we block the blood flow a lot if you block the muscarinic receptor. So it clearly is, you know, stimulus dependent. You activate different populations of cell. And I mean, I think just, this is not surprising. If you look at the innervation of somatostatin cell, about 60% of the somatostatin cells in the cortex receive cholinergic afferents. Okay, so they are a very, very good target of cholinergic terminals. And in electrophysiology, the group of Kawaguchi in Japan has shown that the somatostatin interneurons are the ones that respond the best to muscarinic receptor activation. So I think it is really dependent on the input that is received, the neurotransmitter that is released, you activate different population of cells. Okay? So I will not basically go there, but I think that is the conclusion slide that I will just show here. Okay, I think this is, then you have to take my word. The other work is published anyway for the basal forebrain, so you can go back to the paper. So different cellular networks are activated in response to distant afferent pathways. So glutamate will activate a subset of interneuron, acetylcholine would activate another subset of interneuron. I would be curious to see what noradrenaline or serotonin would activate as subset of interneuron. This is not known. GABA interneurons act primarily, I believe, as local integrator of cortical activity. I do not believe, at least from the in vivo work, that they are the main dilator, that they dilate directly through GABA, the vessels. Peptide may be active as maybe very localized effect beyond the laser Doppler photometry resolution, or are not released under our external paradigm. I think I would suspect they should be because the whisker is a very physiological paradigm. So I believe they are, but we cannot pinpoint them with the laser Doppler. Pyramidal cells are activated directly.
What would you recommend? Would you recommend some kind of dilation,
You know, if you want, I think, to clearly show that your effect is peptide-driven,
yeah.
I think I don't know, but for me, the only proof would be that somebody goes in with a whisker, they put a dialysis probe in the sensory cortex,
yeah.
They take a sample, they measure VIP, and they measure GABA, whatever, but GABA is slowly released. But maybe they can put, you know, if you are in the barrel cortex, maybe you can go into the barrel cortex where you activate it and put a probe right there. I mean, I don't know how sophisticated and how small you can do that. I don't know if that is possible. Or if you don't go into one barrel, you whisker the whole somatosensory cortex with all the whisker, that will give you probably a huge response. Then maybe you can pick it up. But I think that would be the only way, unless you can do that and show that, yes, VIP is released, and if I put a VIP antagonist locally, I don't have a response. I think it is impossible today to say that the peptides are directly involved into the blood flow response. I mean, I wish I could, but I think we have to be honest. I don't think we have experimental data to prove that they are, okay? I think what we can say is that the pyramidal cells are clearly activated, and they can release COX-2 vasoactive dilators. We can block the response. I think that is clear. And I think the EADS probably release an astrocyte, maybe responsible for the glutamate, but maybe also they contribute somehow to the GABA response, and that is something that I hope at some point some people can follow up on that, okay? And I will just, I think I have done nothing here but show the work of clearly Clutzil, Claire and Priscilla on the whisker, Clotzil also on the basal forebrain, and Arakocharian on the basal forebrain, but part of the interneurons on that is published in JCBFM, so I can skip those data. Okay. Oh, well, we are obliged to, actually, yeah. They should put goggles, because according to McGill law, we should go in the lab with goggles, but we don't, you know. Nobody wants to go in the lab with goggles, but this is when I get my inspection, I'm being told that I'm not proper. Yeah.